We were healing and becoming an ecumenical society where race was incidental, not essential to who we are, until the Obamas came. And they just drilled race. And now we're reverting to some kind of tribal Yugoslavia in the United States. When I look at the fundamentals of a society, the military, well, it's short 45,000 recruits. Finance, we're $36 trillion in debt. Education, our schools, our universities, except for the STEM, and that's going to, they're in danger as well. They're not teaching, they're not preeminent anymore. You look at the border, it's not that it's porous, it doesn't exist. 10 million people, we don't know what to do. We'll never be able to audit all 10 million who came in under Biden. The sad thing, as you point out, is they're all self-inflicted.
All right, guys, I'm excited today. It's not only are we halfway through the work week, but Victor Davis Hanson is about to come out. I always love his take. So sit back for a second. But I want to tell you, and I'm going to break this down with Victor in a second, three big developments in the Trump cases. And it's funny, they are all going in his direction. Number one, the New York case, this whole issue with Stormy Daniels yesterday testifying. It didn't go as well as I think the prosecution wanted, but you have to ask, why did the prosecution want her there? It's not even something that's in material to the case. This is about bookkeeping, financial records. How did he make a payment? There's no doubt that the payment was made. She cashed a check. Everyone admits that there was a check. He signed it. So why was she on the stand yesterday? Because the judge was like, oh, I don't know that we need to hear this. Well, he allowed it. In fact, he chided the defense, Trump's team, saying, well, you should have objected more. Like, first, I'm going to put a gag order on you guys. Then you should object more. I mean, this is a little insane. It's immaterial. Even the Today Show this morning is going off about how this was ridiculous and a waste of time. Then down in Florida, you remember that picture that had all the classified documents spread all over the floor, right? And it looked kind of weird because it was like, wow. Well, it turns out all that's staged. And the judge, Eileen Cannon, says, okay, there's way too much stuff here in terms of pretrial motions and how the government has acted, i.e. Jack Smith, that we're going to postpone this indefinitely. Huge win for Trump on that. Never mind the fact that we've all talked about this. Joe Biden, as a vice president, as a senator, had classified information for decades in a lot of places and gave it to uncleared people to read, like his ghostwriter. That was insane. Never mind all that, but that's a win for Trump because now it's pushed off indefinitely. And then in Georgia, just this morning, the Georgia Court of Appeals said that ruling that the Superior Court judge had made that said, hey, it's you have to choose between Fani Willis and Nathan Wade, her boyfriend. And Fani said, yeah, it's me, and get rid of Nathan. The Court of Appeals said, yeah, this still doesn't look right. We're going to review the thing. That's going to buy a ton of time for Trump on that. That's a huge win for him. So in the last 24 hours, that was really big. By the way, going down to Capitol Hill for a second, because I want to touch on this. I don't mean to brag again. I mentioned this in yesterday's show, but what did I tell you? Marjorie Taylor Greene backed down. She put out a statement last night after the show. I was right. She backed down. Now she wants to get some concessions. I talked to you about them yesterday. And I think she'll get some of them, but Johnson acted like a statesman and said, hey, I want all of my members to bring me ideas so we can operate better and more efficiently and in the best interest of the American people. But the Trump pressure worked and she found the right political off-ramp. So anyway, again, just a reminder, we know what we're talking about on the show. Hopefully that's why you tune in. There was supposed to be a hearing, as I mentioned today, on the Hill. The D.C. mayor was getting hauled in front of the House Oversight Committee. James Comer of Kentucky is doing all the Hunter Biden stuff and whatever. Then last night, like 3, 4 a.m., she sends the D.C. police to George Washington University to clean up the encampments. Wow. Then she does a press conference this morning saying, hey, guess what? We're not gonna do this. I want to tell you, I know Mother's Day is just a couple days away. I think you probably have missed the chance here, but Father's Day is coming up. And if you're looking for an unbelievably unique and meaningful gift, I want to suggest to you the folks at Paint Your Life. Look at what I did. I took a photo of me. Now, who wouldn't want this, right? But it's not just a photo. Anyone can have a photo. The folks at Paint Your Life can take any photo or a compilation of photos. So if you have you and a couple family members or you and a pet or who cares, I don't care what it is. Like they take a couple of the photos and they can make it into a beautiful painting. It doesn't matter. It can be charcoal, oil, acrylic, watercolors. You get to choose the type. Then you get to choose the frame. You choose the artist, and the artist sends you back and forth videos of them making this. You get 100% guarantee of what it is. And the ultimate result is a meaningful and unique gift. No one else is going to give something like this. So again, I know you probably want a picture of me, but maybe it's something meaningful that you want to do. And because you can make a compilation, I think that would be really cool. Like I said, it's guaranteed. And right now it's 20% off and free shipping. If you text 87204, use code word Spicer, you get 20% off and free shipping. So this is a great deal on a very unique and cool gift. And maybe it's not Father's Day, maybe it's a birthday, an anniversary, but do something cool and different that nobody else will do this. Remember that message and data rates may apply when you do this, but go to 87204 on your phone, text that, and then text the keyword Spicer. See what Paint Your Life can do for you. All right. Okay. I mentioned this, what didn't happen on the Hill today, but I want to get to another thing that didn't happen. Check this out. So the DC mayor, as I said, she doesn't show up. Oh my gosh, because wow, she finally did her job. But there was also supposed to be a hearing about NPR. The CEO of NPR was supposed to show up on a hearing that was called Examining Accusations of Ideological Bias at NPR, a taxpayer-funded news entity. Shocker. We all knew what this was going to yield. But guess what? Literally an hour or so before the hearing is supposed to start, the CEO sends him and says, I have a scheduling conflict, and doesn't show up. Yeah, nice timing on that, huh? Pretty unbelievable. So just keep that in mind. By the way, another little news revelation, not a big shocker. Boy Scouts of America, no mas. It's now Scouting America. Apparently, they're having recruiting problems. Yeah, no kidding. If I want an organization for my son to grow up in, to learn skills, I want it to be the Boy Scouts. I don't want it to be Scouting for America that allows everyone. I mean, there was a uniqueness. I was a Boy Scout. I wasn't very good at it, by the way, but I was one. So a lot to get to with Victor in just a second. Real quick, by the way, my team did a little dirt digging, and they found out that 67% of the people who watch this show every night are not subscribed. Think about that. Only 37% of the people who watch every night are subscribed. So do me a favor, hit the subscription button and also hit the notification button. We got a bunch of great shows. Kimberly Guilfoyle is going to be here at the end of the week. She was a former assistant district attorney. I'm going to ask her about what they should and shouldn't be doing. So please do that. This is such a great thing. We're going to have Victor Davis Hanson on. As you know, he's got a brand new book out. It's already gone to the top of the charts on Amazon, and it's so prophetic about what's really happening right now. I'm going to talk to him about that. Plus, he just got another award from the Media Research Center. Before I do that, though, I want to tell you about what our friends at Nugenix are doing. And if you text Spicer to 231-231, you can get a complimentary, free is what complimentary makes for those folks not on the right, for those leftists that don't get it. This is truly free. It's not welfare. It's a free complimentary bottle of Nugenix Total Tea. It's got Tesnor in it. So if you're a guy like I am, over 50, I don't care, maybe you're over 40, and you're just not getting the same level of energy and excitement and spring in your step that you've always had, you want to check this out. And like I said, you can't get a better deal than this. Text 231-231, use code word Spicer. You get the free complimentary bottle, plus you're going to get another free gift, a bottle of Thermo X. It is their new fat incinerator. Check this out. I mean, this is the kind of things that if you're not feeling the same level of energy that you've always had, this is what you want to try. So right now, go get that complimentary bottle of Nugenix Total Tea. Text 231-231, keyword Spicer. Texting will enroll you in recurring automated messages. Consent not required to purchase. Message and data rates do apply. It is the number one doctor recommended brand by primary care physicians based on an independent study conducted by IQVIA 2022. All right, let's get into it with Victor Davis Hanson. Victor, always good to have you. Congratulations on another book. I mean, I don't know how you sleep, because every time I turn around, you've got a new book out, but it's not just a new book. You're already at the top of the Amazon charts, and it's only been out a day. Congrats on all your success.
Well, thank you.
All right. I want to get to that in just a minute. I also, by the way, not to keep adding on to the congratulatory remarks here, but I got an email this morning that the Media Research Center has awarded you the Lifetime Achievement Award. Congratulations on that as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It was nice of them.
It was nice of them, but it was also not just nice, it was well-deserved. You've been such an amazing voice at such a high level. And what I mean by that is it's not just clickbait stuff. You are such an intellectual that gives us the basis for so many of our conservative arguments. that it is such a needed voice in the conversation. So, and I think obviously I'm sure that the decision was well before the book came out, the latest book. As I said, I want to get into that in a minute because I think the way that this segues, the conversation I want to have with you will segue nice into the subject of your book. I want to start with the news over the last, literally the last 24 hours. There's three new fronts on Trump's cases. Let's start in New York. This conversation that happened yesterday, the prosecution brings up Stormy Daniels, and then the judge says, I don't know that we needed any of these details. This morning, I'm flicking around the morning shows, and Savannah Guthrie says, it really doesn't matter what she said because it's immaterial to the case. This was all about a bookkeeping issue and financial records versus anything she had to say. So, quote, it doesn't matter if she's lying or not. So why would somebody bring a witness like that if it was immaterial to the case, unless it was ultimately to try to embarrass Trump?
Yeah, I don't think this case has anything to do with the law. Nobody's ever been prosecuted before under this statute. You can't find exactly what the crime was, Alvin Bragg. It was all designed to... The judge wants to be part of this project. He's given to Democrats. His daughter has profited greatly from her Democratic consultantship. One of the prosecutors has given to Democrats. The other one has worked for the DNC. They feel this is a way of getting salacious material, even if it's irrelevant, out there, and that there's going to be a percentage of the voters, when they hear about this, they're going to accept it, despite the credibility problems of Stormy, and it's going to help them. And that's all it's about. So the judge, I think, is a little embarrassed because they pleaded with him not to allow this because it was so not just salacious, but irrelevant. And then when he actually heard her and she got going and got into the really sort of intimate details, then he looked like an idiot. So then he turned around and blamed the defense for not making a stronger argument to him, I guess.
Right. He was like, I'm mad that you didn't object to me enough, even though I've issued a gag order, told you guys not to say anything. You should have objected had I known she said this. But he didn't chide the prosecution, which was interesting because whether or not there was a relationship or not is irrelevant to this case, as you kind of alluded to. This is about how they classified payments to her. Whether there was a relationship or not, whether or not it's true or false, is immaterial to the fact that the case revolves around how it was recorded in the Trump Organization's books. And that's what I thought that was funny. He chided himself for allowing her to go on, the judge did yesterday. He chides the defense for not objecting, but he never stopped the prosecution and said, there's no relevance of this witness because the facts aren't relevant or material to the case. And I thought that was odd. Of all of the three parties, he chided the two that didn't make this really happen. It was the defense, the prosecution that put it forward.
Yeah, I think he gained his objective. He got it out there, and he's a partisan, right. And I say that very carefully, but we saw that.
You're not under a gag order, are you?
Yeah, no. We saw that with the E. Jean Carroll case as well, where the judge said that even though Donald Trump had not been convicted of sexual assault, it was essentially sexual assault. We saw that with the Letitia James, Ms. Ingeron, when he was hamming it up to the cameras. All of these judges have not... acquitted themselves well. The funny thing about it was, though, if Donald Trump had said, when they reported this expense on the non-disclosure, if they had have said this is a campaign expense and reported it, as apparently the DA would have preferred, they still would have gone after him. And they said that's an improper campaign expense. Because we know that because when Hillary Clinton, using the DNC paywall and the Perkins Coal paywall and the Fusion GPS paywall, paid Christopher Steele to compile that fraudulent dossier, she was fined by the Federal Elections Committee over $100,000. And the answer that the Federal Election Committee said, this is not a legal expense. This was some type of campaign expense. So either way, whether he'd said legal expense or campaign expense, they were going to go after him. That was immaterial. Right. They feel that this is part of a larger project to get him off the ballot, as we saw, to put him into five different civil or criminal suits, impeach him twice, try him as a private citizen. It's a larger project that they feel that they're morally superior and they have the right to pretty much break the law and abuse the law.
Well, speaking of abusing and breaking the law, I mean, let's move on to the Florida case. The judge down there, Eileen Cannon, gave Trump a huge break because she made it official that this documents classified case that she's dealing with down there will be delayed indefinitely because there are too many pretrial questions remaining, including the government, Jack Smith, staging this photo. Again, this is like these guys do it to themselves. They literally tried to create the image of something that didn't exist. And she's looking at it saying, hey, guys, sorry, this isn't going to fly. But once again, I mean, all of this happening in a 24-hour period, the Florida case getting indefinitely postponed, got to be good news for Trump because they're admitting that the government is not being straight with the facts.
They are, and they lie. And once they arranged the documents to look like they were had been sloppily kept and the files were confused when they weren't, then they lied about it to the judge. In the official court, they said that they were that they, being the documents, had been poorly kept by Trump, even though that they had been rearranged by themselves. So they lied. They not only set Trump up, but they lied about it. I don't think that case is going to ever go to trial because the judge has also said that she was going to look at the equal application of the law. And we have another special prosecutor who had said in his long her report that Joe Biden illegally not only took out files, but did it apparently for over 30 years and didn't notify the prosecutor. And he only notified the prosecutor after he appointed Joe Biden a special counsel and worried that he had commiserate exposure. And then, of course, the ghostwriter in that case didn't have a classified clearance, and yet he was sharing classified material with Joe Biden to write his memoirs. And then when that was subpoenaed, that tape, he destroyed it. He destroyed a piece of evidence under subpoena. And those are felonies.
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to come up in the Jack Smith thing too, because she said that she was going to look at equal application of the law in addition to that. So I think the Fannie Willis case is going nowhere because we have the two lead prosecutors have pretty much perjured themselves under oath and dreamed up this. They were not telling the truth when their amorous relationship occurred. One of them met with Joe Biden's legal counsel, and they lied, of course, about their expenses and said they were paid in cash, and therefore there was no record. So the only thing that I see, and we'll see if there's some honest jurors, but this case, I think it's taken a turn against the prosecution. But
yeah, I mean, you just mentioned it. This morning, the brand new revelations coming out that the Court of Appeals in Georgia is going to review whether Fannie Willis can stay on the case. They're reviewing the Superior Court's judge who initially said, hey, Fannie Willis or Nathan Wade, one of you got to go. Now the Georgia Court of Appeals is saying maybe Fannie Willis still has to go. But overall, it's almost like, I mean, you alluded to it a second ago, Victor, right? So I've never seen so much mud thrown against the wall. We're going to take you off the ballot. We're going to impeach you twice. We're going to put you up against civil cases. Then we're going to prosecute you on criminal cases in a multitude of jurisdictions. We're basically going to make it impossible for you to run for reelection. But here we go. The dominoes keep falling. In the last 24 hours, huge revelations, potential mistrial in New York based on the Stormy Daniels testimony. In Florida, as we just talked about, indefinite postponement of that case. Fannie Willis's participation being reviewed now by the Georgia Court of Appeals. All this is good news for Trump, but what actually scares me, Victor, is they go, okay, we got to bring out the bigger guns now. We got to figure out, we tried to get him off the ballot. We've tried to do this. I worry about what's next.
Well, I think we know what's next. What's next is enlisting in the 2020 fashion to bring in the Bill Gates money, the Tides Foundation money, the Soros money, the Mark Zuckerberg money, as Molly Ball outlined in that incredible confessional in Time magazine when she says how we, you know, she used the word cabal and conspiracy, a woman of the left, how they sort of altered the balloting. And I think there will be an enormous effort to do the same thing they did in 2020, absorb the work of the registrars and ensure that non-election day percentage of 70% not casting their ballots on election day goes up to 80 or 90%. I think they'll have a problem because this time around, there's a lot of African Americans and Hispanics in the big cities where mail-in balloting is more common that are re-examining their support for the left and Democratic Party. And some of them work within municipal and county government. And I think they're going to be watchful if they favor Trump, that some of their colleagues might try to do something that was allegedly happened in 2020. But I think that's the next move. They want to look at the process of balloting because they have no confidence that Joe Biden, either as a person or his agenda, can win the election.
Let me ask you this. For that reason, and I've asked a lot of guests this, I've gotten a lot of interesting answers. Do you ultimately think that Joe Biden is the nominee in November? Because I wonder if that's the final step that they have to take, which is to say, okay, guys, none of the things are working. We got to get Biden out of the way. We got to put somebody new in. What do you think?
I think at some point in July, they're going to make that assessment. And I think it's going to be dependent entirely on the polls. And if he is in some polls 10 points down and he's underwater on every issue and 10 points down vis-a-vis Trump, and he's down to 38% popularity, and they look at statistics historically and they see he can't win. There's no way he can win when he's only got a 38% approval rating. Then yes, I think they'll force him to release the superdelegates and any delegates that have been crewed. And then they'll open up the convention and they can tell Kamala Harris, we really want you to win, but they know she won't win in an open ballot. And you'll end up with somebody like Josh Shapiro or Gretchen Whitmer or Gavin Newsom. I think that's, and that's well aside from the question of Joe Biden, unfortunately or tragically, he's one step away from oblivion. All he has to do is fall one step or say something crazy off the teleprompter, and he's capable of that. He could say something, he could go back to, you know, you ain't black or junkie or any of the things he said before, but to a global audience. And or he could, you know, stumble or something, fall off a bike. So they have no margin of error trying to continue this candidacy of Joe Biden. But
yeah, so let me ask this: as a historian and academic, I keep hearing about the similarities to 1968, right? The Chicago Convention. I mean, you couldn't script this better, right? You think about the images of Chicago 68, what's about to happen now in Chicago. Oh my gosh, I wonder if it's going to put it to shame with all of these pro-Gaza protests that are going to happen in Chicago. You've got a Kennedy on the ballot, right? You've got a very deeply unpopular president marred in a quagmire in terms of how to deal with all these foreign issues. In that case, Johnson says, I'm not running for reelection. I got to focus, blah, blah, blah. To your previous response, is that you think that some people are saying, hey, we're going to have to kind of do a 1968 here and find a way out?
Yeah, I do. But remember, in 1968, they said they'll never riot because school is out. And they were rioting, doing the same thing they are now about Vietnam and about the Democratic Party and Johnson. And they said, well, school is out. They'll quiet down all summer. They'll go to Chicago and they won't ever mess around with Mayor Daley. But this time, we know that these protests are going to continue, even if they're going to move to the street. And then Mayor Johnson of Chicago is no Mayor Daley. And Mayor Daley could not handle it. And he's going to be sympathetic to it. And so, and they know that. And they looked at what happened in May, June, July of 2020 when Kamala Harris said, you know, this shouldn't stop. It won't stop. It's going to go all the way to the election. I doubt she says that again, but she sympathizes with it. All of these protests are predicated on the idea they take place in blue cities, blue states, blue city councils, blue mayors, blue governors that reinforce the indecision of the college presidents. And they really do sympathize secretly or maybe overtly sometimes with the protesters. So I think the protesters know that. And I think if they go into Chicago, if they are arrested, they will not be charged. And there'll be a lot of people they think in government in Illinois that are sympathetic to them. And that's going to be an incentive for them to go pretty wild, like 68.
All right. If you've been keeping up with the political news, you know that there's been a lot of discussion about animal welfare. How about we put it that way? Well, the beautiful thing is there's always a solution. My friend Leo Grillo founded Delta Rescue. Delta Rescue is a no-kill animal sanctuary. Notice I didn't say shelter, it's a sanctuary. It's a place where dogs, horses, cats, you name it, can go and get the care that they need. Maybe it's nutrition, maybe it's veterinary care. It doesn't matter. Leo Grillo takes them all in and he makes sure that all animals get the care that they need for life. For life. That's what Delta Rescue is all about. And if you go to deltarescue.org, you can see the amazing work that Leo does. Now, Delta Rescue relies entirely on contributions from animal lovers, people who claim that they want to help rescue animals and care for them. This is where you can put your money. This is where you can put your money because he takes care of those animals for life. But they rely totally on our contributions, $100, $1,000, $50, whatever you can do. Help them out. Help keep that mission going. But if you want to do even more and make it part of your legacy, make sure that Delta Rescue is an enduring mission, then check out the estate planning kit on deltarescue.org and see if you could make Delta Rescue part of your estate so that what Leo Grillo has founded will live in perpetuity. Go to deltarescue.org and check it out. Thank you.
Yeah.
Speaking of protests, there's supposed to be this big hearing in the House Government and Oversight Committee today. James Comer had forced D.C. Mayor Muro Bowser to come testify why they had such a tepid, if any, response to these. They're calling them encampments on the George Washington University campus. Well, guess what happened last night? Holy smokes. The D.C. police in the middle of the night, like 2, 3 a.m., shows up at GW University and starts ripping these kids out of the tents, telling them that it's time to go. They're going to be arrested. And all morning have been arresting folks. She does a press conference and says, hey, Comer called. We're going to cancel the hearing because we're in the middle of doing this. The timing was, I'll give her credit. She knew she was going to get raked over the coals in Congress this morning. So she finally sends the DC police last night to make it stop. Comer, of course, is now in a pickle because he doesn't want to take her away from executing on this action that they're taking. But this is where these things are, where these mayors, I mean, this goes to your previous point. They sympathize with these folks. You've seen it in New York. They go, oh, well, it's a private university. We can't do anything. You know, they're allowing this to happen. The university administrators, the blue city mayors, whether it's Johnson in Chicago or Adams in New York, or now Bowser in DC, they're sympathetic to these folks.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's very little chance that the mayor of Washington will order 20,000 federal troops and miles of barbed wire as she did after January 6th one-day demonstration. Remember, that was the largest militarization of Washington since Jubal Early was outside the city limits of Washington in 1864. So I doubt, my point is that she's very capable of locking down the city in a very militaristic, deterrent fashion. And they've done it before, but they won't do it this time. But she finally had to act. And again, those people that were arrested will be let go. And
it's funny, during this press conference I had this morning, they were talking about some of them had been arrested for assaulting police officers. And I kept thinking to myself, this goes back to your point about the militarization over there. After January 6th, it was very clear, we need to put these people in jail. If you've assaulted a police officer, we're going to, you know, make you wait your turn. And yet this morning, there's no similar outrage on the left about assaulting police officers. They, you know, the chief of police is saying, yes, they took punches at us. And yet again, I don't hear any outrage from folks on the left about assaulting police officers.
They don't really see that as a crime. And you can even see that it's even stranger. Anytime in America where a suspect is shot lethally by a police officer and the suspect is committing a misdemeanor and is unarmed, then the officer's name is plastered all over the papers and there's a big investigation immediately, and sometimes there's riots. But during that January 6th, when Ashley Babbitt went through an already broken window, 5'1", about 90 pounds, 14-year military veteran, Officer Byrd shot her lethally. We didn't know anything about him for 6 months. It was suppressed. And then the left said, what did the left do when they heard the news that a woman who was shot unarmed by a police officer, they immediately started attacking her character. They started looking at her sexual life, her marriage, everything about her to demonize her. The left doesn't see this as, they don't see any consistency as needed. All they feel is that we are for the people, we're for radical equality of result, equity, they call it, and any means necessary, and that's the term they're using on the campus, are justified because we are intellectually and morally superior to our opponents, and therefore we can be on any issue, on any side, as we see fit. And they do that because they control the institutions, as you know, the media, the corporate boardroom.
Yeah, the ends always justify the means.
Yeah, they do.
But you bring that up. I got this great chart. I mean, talk about it. And I know this doesn't shock you because you've been on college campuses, in Stanford, et cetera. But there's a tweet or a graph that Nate Silver, the founder of 538, put out, which, again, I don't know that it's that shocking, but it lists all of these elite schools, Brown University, University of Pennsylvania, Stanford. It talks about how Brown is 79% liberal and 7% conservative. That's an 11-to-1 ratio. Again, I don't know that this is shocking to me, but it was interesting to see it visually. Stanford is 68% liberal, 15% conservative, a 5-to-1 ratio. I feel like we're getting the fruits of what these colleges bear. I mean, it's garbage in, garbage out. We're expecting to somehow think that these people that we're training in a liberal ideology and a liberal orthodoxy is somehow going to come out different. But this is what is happening on college campuses, and I don't think we should be surprised. And that's why I kind of wanted to start to tie this into your book a little bit, because I worry that we're training people with the wrong things. We're giving them the wrong degrees. We're not training them to be ready to take on the challenges of the new year, of the new century. We're not talking about the challenges that China faces. It's the challenges that the new job market and technology faces. We're giving them the degrees in basket weaving and gender studies, which literally just saddle them with debt, but don't actually prepare them to face the challenges that we face as a nation.
Well, I mean, the average student anywhere in the United States takes 6 years to graduate, and half of them who enroll in college in their first year don't finish. And then, more importantly, they end up with an average of about $90,000 in debt. And if you look at the general education, which is the key to a university education, it's completely been ransacked. So they don't learn analysis, English composition, fluency in the oral language. They don't have any mathematical skills. And that's kind of been a little sidelight on all of these demonstrations, where a reporter will come up to somebody and say, river to the sea, which river, which sea? They don't know the Jordan River. They do not know the Mediterranean Sea. What is an intifada mean? They have no idea. What's your scarf? What's the history of it? What's 1947? So they're very ignorant and arrogant. And I think the universities, though, are panicking because so much of their endowment is long-term invested, and that endowment income could be taxed. I think a Republican government would tax that endowment income, probably wind down the student loans, give a second look at these massive federal grants. And we should remember that the operating budget of these universities comes out of annual giving, and they don't want to touch the endowment income. They reinvest it because it's long term. So when you see 10%, 20% of the funding hasn't been there the last 2 years, these universities are now panicking.
I've got a chart showing how much we as taxpayers, the federal government, is funding these universities. Columbia, $1.2 billion. Penn, $955 million. Yale, yes. $700 million. I mean, aren't we also picking up the tab for this?
Yes. That's why it's so frustrating to see these entitled students that say, we have our say, we pay the tuition, but the tuition, as high as it is, 90,000 room and board tuition, is subsidized by us. Because we not only give direct federal grants to these universities, but we subsidize the students on low interest loans that a third of them are not performing. And more importantly, we do not tax their endowment income. And yet they're blatantly political entities now. And but you can see what's happening at Stanford. They all of a sudden, they just chose their new president, and he's the dean of the business school and a white male who's not left wing. And that was unheard of. 3 years ago, they were talking that would never happen again. So you can see that money starts to affect these universities. And that's why they're starting to clean up some of these campuses, because they're getting calls that I guess what I'm trying to say is their trademark, their brand, is going the way of Disney or CNN or Target or Bud Light. And they're worried about it, because when you say, I got a degree from Columbia, people are going to say, I don't think I want that person in my corporation or my division, because he won't know very much, and he'll go right to human resources the moment we hire him and cause trouble.
I don't need that in my company.
No, but
you mentioned, we talked about the giving, right? The endowment, the federal thing. But there's also another stat that's come out about gifts from foreign countries, including Qatar, $3.2 billion, China, $1.7 billion, Saudi Arabia, $1.2 billion, the UAE, $630,000, Russia, $140,000. According to the Department of Energy, or Department of Education, sorry, American universities and colleges have received $19 billion in foreign donations with no recorded dates of receipt as of April 6, 2023. These guys are, we're being infiltrated from the inside out.
Well, we have a million foreign students, and that's because they pay full tuition, and they get no discounts, and they're a big money machine for these universities. But the statistics you quoted are what the university reports to the Department of Education. You got to remember that a lot of them have been fined. Stanford University, where I work, was fined $50 million for underreporting Chinese contributions, and they didn't want to talk about it. And so these universities are getting money from foreign governments to create centers so that when they send thousands, tens of thousands of their students over there, they gravitate to friendly faculty that are on these endowed fellow professorships, and then they indoctrinate them in the Middle East, in China, et cetera, et cetera. And we really need, I mean, they're all on student visas, and all we had to do, any college president would have to do is arrest one of them when they break a law or break one of the statutes at the university. And then if we had a normal government, they'd say your student visa is no longer operative. You got to go home. If you did that with 1,000 students, it would stop. Because one thing we know about the foreign students, they can yell death to America and Genocide Joe and all of this stuff. But the one thing they demand is to stay in the United States. They can they praise Hezbollah, Hamas, but they do not want to go back to those places where they have no freedom, no equality between the sexes, no education, no good medical care. And they know they would be arrested for what they're doing here in their home country. And they know if they're gay or they're hanging out with LGBTQ or they're flying the pride flag, they'd be put in jail at great possibility of injury to their life. And they know that. Oh. So they will do anything to stay in the United States. And if they break the law, there's no reason they should.
Absolutely. But let me ask you this. The book that you've got out, and a brand new book that you have out right now, deals with the end of everything. And based on everything that I just said to you, we're allowing these adversaries to fund our universities. You got Confucius Centers funded by China. They sent a spy balloon over our country, and we wait for 14 days so everyone can post photos on Instagram of it. How much of this is self-inflicted? Are we doing this to ourselves based on what we've looked at, how empires have fallen in the past? Are we sort of staring at this and saying, oh, wow, here we go?
Yeah, we are. When I looked at ancient Thebes, Carthage, Constantinople, and the Aztec city, Tenochtitlan, modern Mexico City, they all had one thing in common. They all lived in the past. So they said, at one time, we're here 1,000 years in Thebes. We've been here 800 years in Carthage. We've been here 1,100 years. This could not happen to us. Look at our walls. They're formidable. We're the strongest power. And they didn't look at their actual power vis-a-vis the type of people that were trying to destroy them. So they said, Alexander the Great wouldn't dare do this. Scipio couldn't do this. Our walls have never been breached at Constantinople or Carthage. And the fact was, all of the things that we're talking about, debt, they were all in debt. Their populations were divisive. Their militaries were eroded. They were dreaming of how great they are without ever any self-examination. And they fell, all of them fell. When you look at us, if we're borrowing $1 trillion every 100 days and the interest on the debt is higher than what we spend on defense, and when you look at our foreign policy, the pullout from Afghanistan, the Ukraine war, the Gaza war, the Chinese balloon, it's all predicated on our enemies feel that they can take, in a cost-benefit analysis, they can take risks because they feel the United States either can't or won't do something. And then when you look at here at home, I think that started with the Obamas. We are racially divisive. Once we were healing and becoming an ecumenical society where race was incidental, not essential to who we are, until the Obamas came and they just drilled race. And now we're reverting to some kind of tribal Yugoslavia in the United States. Our crime is out of control. And so when I look at the fundamentals of a society, the military, well, it's short 45,000 recruits. Finance, we're $36 trillion in debt. education, our schools, our universities, except for the STEM, and that's going to, they're in danger as well. They're not teaching and they're not preeminent anymore. And when I look at crime, most people avoid downtown blue cities now. They feel it's too unsafe and they're medieval. So there's a lot of barometers, and we look at the border. It's not that it's porous, it doesn't exist. 10 million people, we don't know what to do. We'll never be able to audit all 10 million who came in under Biden. The sad thing, as you point out, is they're all self-inflicted. They weren't due to a natural disaster, or they weren't due to a plague or anything. It was all self-induced the last 4 years.
Well, it's funny. You say that all these previous empires, one of the reflections they have is our walls can't be breached. We don't even have that. We're saying, come on in. There's no wall to breach. We've cut holes in the walls, in the fences. Come on in. And I can't help but think to myself, as I reflect on some of the things that you talk about in the book, that we're creating it. It's not even that we're ignorant about it. We're literally doing it. We're saying we're going to create a woke military environment. We're going to have an open border. We're going to rack up more debt. We're almost tempting fate.
We are. And I think that's because all of us think there's a normal Democratic Party, and then there's an extreme base that has taken over, the Squad, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, the Black Caucus, BLM, Antifa. I don't think that's an accurate assessment. I think the entire Democratic Party now is hard left socialist. And they feel that the United States was flawed at the beginning. It got worse during its duration, and now it's toxic. And they want to radically change it. They want to pack the court. They want to get rid of the Electoral College. They want to take a look at two senators representing every state. They want two states admitted. They want to get rid of the Senate filibuster. And they don't like the process. They don't like the institutions. They don't like the military. They want to turn it into kind of a woke social project. And that's what they're doing. They're even changing the foundational date of the United States, 1619. So this is a multifaceted revolution. And it's wrong to say, well, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and people like that, they're at odds with us. They're not. They're scared of them, and they've joined them. Chuck Schumer, you know, when he gets on the floor of the Senate and starts attacking a foreign government that's elected and basically advocating to overthrow the elected government of Israel, he's about as radical. And this is the same person who got in front of the Supreme Court and said, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, you're going to reap the whirlwind. You don't know what's going to hit you. And shortly, within 2 years, we have protesters at the Supreme Court justices' homes. So it's the mainstream Democratic Party that has been absorbed by the base. And they're indistinguishable now. They're the same, one and the same.
So
the only person I can see it's not is John Fetterman. He seems to be the only old-fashioned Democrat.
Let's see. I saw him yesterday. He did an interview on Fox, and I was like, what is going on that Fetterman is now the voice of reason? It worries me that, like, we're like, wow, John Fetterman, considering the election that he just had with Oz and how we were talking about how he can't put a sentence together, he doesn't. And now we're like, wow, that's the reasonable guy. Let me ask you a two-parter. Based on what you wrote and the way that you've analyzed history, one, how long do we have? And two, is there any turning back the clock?
Well, in all of these cases, I looked at the final denouement, but there had been periods prior to that where they were in extremis. And the Thebans, for example, had a revolution in 371 where they were preeminent for almost 40 years before they were destroyed. And of course, Carthage, under Hannibal in the Second Punic War, was at the gates of Rome. So they had their periods of renewal, but there was a general decline like this. In our case, there are fundamentals that are in our favor. We could be the largest gas and oil producer and have cheap energy. We could have the most secure border in the world go back to stopping catch and release, refugee status abroad, and finish the wall. We do have the greatest farming sector, fuel sector. If we got rid of these big city prosecutors, we could reintroduce 1990s reforms that made New York a very safe place. So it's all within us. But the problem, as I mentioned in the book, when people discuss this, it's what the historian Livy said: we are afraid of the medicine that is worse than the disease. In other words, for us, we know what's wrong, but if we were to do it, we feel that it would be impossible. Because in our case, imagine building a wall, deporting 10 million people, making a big campaign to fire these prosecutors, charging people across state lines for racketeering that are like in 2020, stopping the violence on campus. Anybody who did that would be called, you know, homophobic, racist, sexist, and they don't want to do that. So the left has made some great deterrence that to correct, all of us are going to have to step up, because we are the majority that don't like this. And we'd all have to say, I'm going to vote. I'm going to give to candidates. I'm not just going to move to Tennessee. I'm not just going to turn off the Oscars or not watch another NBA take a knee thing. I'm actually going to get engaged, and I don't care what people say about me.
That's what we need.
It's a badge of honor. And if we all did that, I think we could stop it.
Okay. That's a great place to wrap this up, because I think that's the answer. Get engaged. Yeah. Too much is at stake. Victor, congratulations on another great book, another bestseller. The book out now at the top of the Amazon charts, The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. And once again, congratulations on the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Media Research Center. Extremely well-deserved.
Thank you, Sean. I much appreciate it.
All right, folks. Reminder, tomorrow, great panel discussion Friday, Kimberly Guilfoyle. She was a district attorney, worked in the district attorney's office in San Francisco in California. She's going to give us some amazing insight. So let's make sure you subscribe right now. Hit that notification button, YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Apple. We'll see you back here tomorrow with another great episode of The Sean Spicer Show.